from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. New documentary, A Fierce Green Fire, traces the history of the modern environmental movement, chronicling dramatic battles like the Sierra Club's fight against dams in the Grand Canyon, Greenpeace's campaign to save whales, and recent efforts to combat climate change. San Francisco-based director Mark Kitchell, who also made the Academy Award-nominated Berkeley in the 60s, joins us in studio. And good to have you here. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The film, by the way, I should mention, will open Friday at Shattuck Cinemas in Berkeley and at Opera Plaza in San Francisco. And what an ambitious project to talk about the whole environmental movement with, I must say, some pretty beautiful shots, too, as well as some very startling ones. Talk about the genesis of this movie. I believe it's Philip Shakeroff of the New York Times who wrote this book with this title, and that's where the title comes from. But the title also goes back to Aldo Leopold.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, we were using the title in the Philip Shabakov sense as describing the movement as a fierce green fire. But it goes back to Aldo Leopold, one of the great pioneers, who as a young ranger, one of his first acts was to shoot a wolf. That was their job. And he saw a fierce green fire in the dying wolf's eye, and it was his awakening.
There's also an awakening. I mean, the film takes us through five acts, and we'll talk about what you've done here and how you've structured it. But one of the acts involves Greenpeace and whale hunting, and you see this eye of the whale, and it's pretty compelling. I mean, and you realize just how powerful it is to actually look a whale in the eye, let alone a wolf, which is a lot about what we're, I suppose, talking about when we're talking about the environmental movement. But the first act is about conservation and, in fact, takes us through Hetch Hetchy and takes us into the fight for the Grand Canyon and fight against damming the Grand Canyon, which my old friend David Brower was right at the head of. And boy, it's spectacular to realize and to remember all that history, but also to see people who, most of them have actually graced the studio. I mean, these are the main movers and shakers are out here in Northern California, at least in that first act.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's the greatest hits, and it's got all the greatest leaders, at least the ones that we didn't leave out.
You been getting any flack about that at this point?
No, actually, and I've been through this twice now, first with Berkeley in the 60s and now with this, and I'm not getting much flack, which is pretty surprising.
Well, it's an eye-opener in so many ways, and we learned about the Sierra Club. We kind of get the whole history of the Sierra Club. You open things up. You have, I should mention also, in these five acts, five different narrators. The first begins with Robert Redford. And then you have Ashley Judd and Van Jones, Isabel Allende, and Meryl Streep. Quite a mix there.
Yeah.
How were they selected for each act?
Oh, it was a process. Veronica Selver, my editor, said, "Mark, you got to have multiple. You should try multiple narrators because I'm getting tired of listening to you doing the temp narration." And so we started. And you know, the first ask was Robert Redford. You know, I tried everything I knew to get to Meryl Streep and then just did a straight-ahead ask to her agent, and they said yes right away, which I think is a real testament to her good taste in politics.
But, well, one of the major early fights, as I said, in the movie was the battle against the damming of the Grand Canyon. We want to hear a clip. We'll hear a few clips from the film. This starts with Robert Redford as the narrator, but it's followed by 92-year-old Grand Canyon activist Martin Litton.
In 1965, the Bureau of Reclamation announced plans to build two power dams and a tunnel to connect them through the heart of the Grand Canyon. It would have killed the river that carved the canyon, and it led to the pivotal battle against the dam builders.
Here you have the river coming along, and the marble dam is going to stop it. It's going to divert it through a tunnel that's going to go way downstream. They were going to take the water out of the river, all of it, except for 1,000 cubic feet per second, you know? There'd be no water in the river. I was appalled at the idea that there would be development in the Grand Canyon, there would be a dam, and it was acceptable. No. My attitude was always, be unreasonable. Let's not be nice. I mean, if you don't have any hatred in your heart, what are you living on?
Well, many people can't imagine the Grand Canyon Grand Canyon Dam, but it came close to happening. And before we get there, we get to some of the other Sierra Club fights, including the loss of And it was a big loss, really, of, well, not only Hetch Hetchy, but Glen Canyon. I mean, and so you take us through that whole metamorphosis of Sierra Club and the break, Brower's break with it, Friends of the Earth and all of that. I mean, there's a lot of history embedded in here, the whole history of the movement. I mean, you're trying to cover so much.
Yeah, well, that was the thing about the film. That was the main challenge, was to try and do a grand synthesis, to bring together all the pieces and parts and eras and aspects of the movement and put them together for the first time. It was pretty surprising that it had never been done. And I can see why now. It was such a big, ambitious undertaking. But it was a great thrill to sort of do that synthetic work of history.
Yeah, I felt like I was going back to hundreds and hundreds of programs that we've done, you know, because so many people that are featured are people that have been featured on this program, and so many of the fights have been on this program. You get into the second act with pollution mainly and with Love Canal. And in fact, it was another defining moment certainly for the movement. For you younger listeners, and there are a lot of them, Love Canal was a residential community in upstate New York located on a toxic site. And in the late 70s, chemicals were leaking into schools, burning children, pets, and experts said causing birth defects and miscarriages. This is a local resident in the film, Liz Ritten.
I carried a child for 9 months. Our little Julie was stillborn. The loss of our child may be a direct result to the chemicals. Please don't allow this to happen to anyone else before you get them out. Don't let it happen to yourselves.
Talking with Mark Hitchell, director, writer, producer of A Fierce Green Fire, The Battle for a Living Planet, which opens Friday at Shattuck Cinemas in Berkeley and Opera Plaza in San Francisco. And
we have to add the Rafael in San Rafael.
Let's add it. How significant was Love Canal, in your judgment, to this whole environmental movement?
Oh, I think it was a real pivotal thing. It was coming in from left field. It was working class. It was, as Lois Gibbs says in the intro to the act, you know, people were talking about birds and fish, and if the...
We should mention Lois Gibbs was a resident
right,
of Love
she's
Canal.
She's the leader of Love Canal, yeah. A great character, a great leader still to this day, 35 years after she is leading that fight against toxic pollution and chemicals. And she's my real heroine in the film, and doing good work with the film even now. What's the point? I'm sorry, I lost the
point. Well, we were talking about how important Love Canal is just to the movement, although you make it evident in the, and we start actually in this section of the film with Rachel Carson, but you make it evident in that segment how much Nixon did for the environmental movement, which is an irony that a lot of people can't get their heads around, and how much Reagan moved back and against the environmental movement, especially with James Watt as Secretary of Interior.
But the point about Love Canal is it brought in the people part of the problem and the people part of the movement, and it was coming from the grassroots, and it was not Brower and the Sierra Club, and it was not the old conservation movement. It was really something new.
A major shift, really.
Yeah.
Major transformation. Well, then we get into Greenpeace, and we get into, the fight to save the whales and the moratorium that succeeded, and the film features dramatic footage of Greenpeace's clashes with Russian whaling ships. Let's hear from that.
We're coming upon a floating slaughterhouse. There's blood in the water. There's huge slabs of blubber being hauled up on these big factory ships. Blood is just pouring out of this pipe, and the stench alone made us all want to throw up.
Suddenly, Bob and I were in a small boat in front of a Soviet harpoon vessel that was bearing down on us. In front of us is eight magnificent sperm whales that were fleeing for their life, and every time the harpooner tried to get a shot, I was at the helm, so I would maneuver the boat to try and block the harpoon.
Here's the whales, here's us in our Zodiacs, and here's the Russian ship. We are right between the Soviet ship and the whales. And the harpooner's not shooting, but eventually somebody from the bridge walks down the catwalk and talks to the harpooner. And the harpooner nods, and the guy goes back. And Bob looks in his eyes, and he knows, this guy's going to shoot this harpoon.
Then he looked at us and smiled and brought his finger across his neck, and that's when I realized Gandhi wasn't going to pull through for us that day.
And at that very moment, they fire the harpoon.
Just one of the really highly dramatic moments in a new film by Mark Kitchell, who's here with us in studio. It's called A Fierce Green Fire, The Battle for a Living Planet. This all comes under Act Three, which is sort of ecology.
Yeah, remember, you know, one of the tests we do with young audiences is in the Earth Day scene, there's an ecology flag, and people are marching with it, and we ask them if anybody knows that symbol, and most of them don't.
Yeah. Well, that's sad. I mean, maybe that's the next film. What's happened to the environmental movement with all these five acts? But there, especially Greenpeace, and you get into the harp seals and so forth in this section, there are many who point out that that set the environmental movement back in many respects because there was a kind of terrorism that was identified, and then you had, you know, a lot of aspersions cast on environmentalists. Backlash, really.
Well, I think that comes later, and that's maybe Animal Liberation Front more than it is Greenpeace and Paul Watson. I mean, Paul Watson was kicked out of Greenpeace for grabbing a sailor, a sealer's club and throwing it in the water. And it was, frankly, bogus.
They almost harpooned poor Paul Watson as a result. I mean, they brought him up on the ship and kicked him and beat him. And, well,
And, you know, there was part of that. Greenpeace was under pressure from its new American supporters to be very strict about its nonviolence. And they had started from that place. You know, they had started protesting nuclear weapons and, you know, sailing into the waters of Mururoa or the Aleutians and, you know, getting escorted out and sometimes beaten up and put in the hospital. But it was, you know, there is throughout the movement, there are versions of going too far and versions of extremism and people getting kicked out and splits happening. And I like the way Rex Weiler talks about Paul Watson getting kicked out is he went and formed his own group, Sea Shepherd, and both organizations thrived, and it was sort of like an amoeba splitting, and everything keeps growing.
Talking again with Mark Kitchell, and you also cover environmental justice in your film, and I'd like the listeners to hear a cut. There's a whole section on environmental justice, including the early fight over a PCB landfill in Warren County, North Carolina.
It was not until Warren County, where that toxic waste landfill was placed in the middle of this predominantly black county, that began to galvanize people to talk about this whole idea of environmental racism.
The protesters were told not to block the trucks. They're now lying in the streets now, blocking one truck, moving into the landfill. They're refusing in order to move, and they are being arrested one by one.
I would like to live in peace, and I'll go to jail in peace.
This black community being dumped on, being targeted, and people saying, no, we have a right to live in a clean and healthy environment. That's when the whole idea of environmental justice as a national movement came into effect.
Again, if you're just joining us, Mark Kitchell's here with us in studio, director, writer, and producer of A Fierce Green Fire, The Battle for a Living Planet, which opens Friday at Shattuck Cinemas in Berkeley and Opera Plaza in San Francisco and the Raphael Theater in San Rafael, a real powerful chronicling of the whole environmental movement from its early days right up into the present. And we asked our listeners, you know, who are your environmental heroes? And I got to tell you, one of mine is Chico Mendez, who became really a martyr to the environmental movement. Isabel Allende, in fact, narrates this section, and it tells the whole story of Chico Mendez, and it's really a lot of focus on him, which I thought was great. What do you want people to walk away from this movie with?
We're looking to do four basic things: educate, inspire, recruit, meaning a new generation or two, and mobilize those of us who've been around for a while and are maybe beaten down or discouraged. It's quite a hat trick to pull off a history of the environmental movement that's actually optimistic. And it's mainly success stories. It's four big stories that are all successes. And then the fifth one, which is, you know, the greatest challenge humanity's ever faced.
Called the mother of all environmental challenges, I think, in the movie. Climate change, yeah.
Yeah.
Optimism?
Yeah, and I think it's not cheap or platitudes. I think it's, you know, coming out of the material and coming out of the movement's experience. And, you know, there's this funny dynamic, Michael, that goes on in the movement where whenever it's threatened with being marginalized or, you know, the movement's dead or, you know, it's fails to meet a challenge, you know, the issues, the challenges come back and force it back to the front of politics and social activism. And it's we're about 25 years into trying to deal with climate change since James Hansen's testimony in Congress. It's a long battle.
It is an ongoing battle, and in fact, Stuart Brand begins talking about Gaia and all that, and we see the whole vision of what we understand as climate change unfolding in your film. Again, really kudos to you on that. I want to give out the phone number and tell listeners how they can join this conversation. We may have memories, distinct memories of the environmental movement that particularly stand out, or environmental heroes. We do the Goldman Awards every year, and Chico Mendes, in fact, was one of those environmental heroes, but you may have your own. Talk about the whole history of the environmental movement, because that's what this new film by Mark Kitchell is all about, and we do welcome your involvement. Join the conversation. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, and the time to join us would be now. Another half-hour segment of Forum, and we do welcome your calls. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. And we asked on Facebook for listeners to share their environmental heroes, and here's some listener responses. James writes, an area hero of mine is David Schooley, who's the founder of the San Bruno Mountain Watch. I attended a talk he gave and found out that he refuses to own a car because of the calamitous results of highway building through the San Ramon Valley, Highway 680. Sarah writes, John Muir, Jane Goodall, to name a couple. Sherry writes, Bill Cordom of Petaluma, who helped stop the nuclear power plant at Bodega Head on San Andreas Fault, fought for coastal access to Sea Ranch, which resulted in the formation of the California Coastal Commission, our protectors of the coast, and became a county supervisor, was recalled by Development Friends, started Sonoma County Conservation Action, a grassroots group marrying the political with the environmental, and initiated Sonoma County's Agricultural Preservation and Open Space District, mentor to many. We have a lot of these local heroes. You could just do a whole movie on them.
Hopefully it's a gateway film that leads to lots of discussions about local and other heroes, you know, other battles, other causes.
Well, let's hear from our listeners. Go to our callers. John, you're up first. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to say I really respect and admire Yvon Chouinard for his activity through the environmental movement, just pointing towards how you integrate a corporation into kind of a responsibility perspective of a company. I'll take my comments up here. Thanks.
Okay, thank you for the call. Well, Mark, you're nodding your head at that.
Patagonia just contributed to the film. They've been following it for most of the 10 years we've been making it, and it's a thrill to have Yvon Chouinard.
So this has been 10 years in the making, yeah.
11 with maybe 3, 4, 5 out in the middle.
Mm-hmm. What's next? Stay with the environment?
Yeah, I'd love to do a follow-on film to this, what we might call Act 6, which is the present and the future of the movement. There's a lot going on now. It's interesting stuff all over the world, from Germany and China to here, you know. I also proposed a museum, a green museum, for Chrissy Field in the Presidio. I did not know I was up against George Lucas. We'll see what becomes of that. But it would make a great museum. I'm thinking about something about the internet. I'd love to do Hardly Strictly Bluegrass as a film. You know, there's lots of stuff.
Yeah, things are cooking. Let me go to more calls. Joan, you're on. Hi.
Hi, I'm from Petaluma, and I am someone who's been mentored by Bill Cordom. I wanted to say the movement is alive and well on the local level. We're fighting for 5 years here the approval of an asphalt factory next to wetlands in Petaluma, the Dutra Asphalt Plant, and we're waiting for a date at court for our appeal at appellate court, and the community and the city council is united. Does not want this plant to degrade a wetlands that the people have paid to restore. So it's alive and kicking, but you know, it's the long haul. It's not a sprint; it's a long distance run.
Well, stay in the race, and thank you for the call.
Thank you.
And here's James, who writes, as the film illustrates, successful activists and their campaigns have repeatedly inspired others to organize within their own communities to achieve similar successes. The better we spread information about individual accomplishments, the more likely it is that others will see these goals as attainable. And I'm struck by those remarks about when the section on Greenpeace and the whales, there's this idea of dropping media bombs, that really sort of moved the movement forward in many ways, didn't it?
Yeah, well, it's part of a theme about media, and Brower was the master of media too. And we found that when Paul Watson started talking about Greenpeace being the first environmental media organization, we went, wait a minute, we can't say that.
No, especially when you think of some towering figures like David Brower. But Greenpeace certainly got a lot of media coverage, to put it mildly. Yeah. Let me go to some more of your calls, and Krista joins us next. Krista, you're on. Hi.
Hi there. I was wondering, I'm a mom of a fourth grader. I was wondering if a 9-year-old and 10-year-old should see this movie.
The only caveat is that there's a shot of a baby harp seal being bludgeoned. Other than that, it's perfectly appropriate.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you for the call. And on to a caller from Sacramento. Catherine, good morning.
Yes,
you're on
for good morning. I'm advocacy chair for the United Nations Association here. I've been working on air quality and climate change. I'm wondering how we can get this film in Sacramento. We need to continue our work, signal work that we did at the Capitol on carbon, not a tax on carbon, but on cap and trade. But what we need is a tax on carbon. And
I agree. The website is the gateway for everything.
Oh, okay.
And we'd love to do it. We're eager for screenings wherever and with whomever.
Would you give your website?
I will. It's http://afearscreenfire.com. And that's four words. A, fierce, spelled F-I-E-R-C-E, greenfire.com.
And there is a link on our website as well, Catherine, so you can find it on kqed.org. And I hope you get it to Sacramento.
Indeed.
There's when you talk about pollution, the second act, as it were, we get into how things really begin to move toward the grassroots level. It was that that brought it to the grassroots level, the pollution fight, really.
Yeah, well, you know, the conservation movement that preceded the environmental movement was accused of being, you know, white and middle to upper class and not really connected to the ground, to people of color, to the grassroots. And there was a NIMBY era where people were fighting literally to save their lives and their homes from nuclear chemicals. There was a witch's brew of synthetic chemicals. I think of Times Beach. There was a time when all over the country, people were fighting. And I couldn't quite do it justice. I tried as hard as I could, but it was too much to get into one little 10-minute sequence, right?
Well, you make the point, though, I think, and also make the point that about that white elitist charge that had been made against the environmental movement. When you get into environmental justice, it became a national movement, but it was ignored for quite some time by environmental groups.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, that's sort of the raw truth of it, isn't it? Looking at a couple more emails here, Elizabeth writes, because we in the public have to trust the news media for our information about the movement, and because journalists have bias in transmitting news about extremism and excess, I'm interested in your guest's views about how well his truth was served by the news media.
Me? Mine? Well, other than one bad review in the New York Times, we're doing great. People are loving the film, and we're doing a grassroots version of getting the word out. And
I think she means more the truth as you see it, or the truth as you're disseminating it in the movie, how that conforms with the way the truth is viewed by the media. And you have clearly a vision of how you see the environmental movement, its causes, its relationship to those causes. Does that connect to media coverage?
I don't know quite how to answer that, Michael.
About the coverage of the media throughout history, I mean, of the environment of the movement? You think it's been fair and equitable or not?
Yeah, I do think it's been fair. I think there's a lot of very smart people within the movement and covering the movement. And, you know, they bring their hearts and their minds to it and have tried hard. It's kind of a tragedy what's happening with the New York Times killing its green blog and so on. But, you know, there's a long history of being underdogs.
Richard writes, Greenpeace people are my heroes. Taking on the French Navy, ocean-borne ships for monitoring and the like reflects a commitment that is unmatched. And I want to get another caller on, and that's Juan Carlo. Good morning.
Oh, hi. It's Juan Carlos from San Rafael. Great program. I'm a big fan of your program. And what I wanted to say is that something that I believe is very important, along with all that has been mentioned, is environmental education. And this is not about kids and new generations learning the names of trees or plants or birds or whatever, but rather creating a sense of place, knowing the biodiversity and knowing that that's the first step in caring for something. I work for WildCare here in San Rafael, and there's things that regular people can do. If they have time, they can volunteer to become docents and really, really help with this, with introducing younger generations to what's around them. I see it as a problem. Kids are not getting outside enough.
All right, Juan Carlo, thank you for that. And Mark, I wish you good luck with the film. Congratulations again.
Well, thanks. May I do a pitch?
Of course.
I mean, this is coming straight from the filmmaker's heart. You know, we're at the beginning of releasing the film, and it's important that it get out there and seen as far and wide as possible. We think we can reach 10 million people worldwide, but this is where we're trying to reach escape velocity. This is where we're trying to reach critical mass, get out of the documentary ghetto.
This is Act One.
So we want you to come out to the theaters, please, please, please.
Let me mention again.
It'll be an act of politics to come see this film.
Theaters, again, it's opening Friday at Shattuck Cinemas in Berkeley and Opera Plaza in San Francisco and Rafael Theater in San Rafael. Again, thank you, Mark Kitchell, for being with us this segment of Forum. Another one is coming your way. We're going to actually talk about people who are alive and working with the dead. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.